It is Monday, August the 10th. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for being with us. Coming up, how the Kurds view the U.S. airstrikes and do they feel apart from the rest of Iraq?
The feeling up here is that Kurdistan is a de facto separate country. They don't feel that they're part of Iraq.
Also ahead, upsurge in Taliban attacks in Afghanistan plus hacking a Pentagon email account. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The U.S.-led campaign of airstrikes against Islamic State militants is getting a major boost now from Turkey. Six American F-16 fighter jets arrived at Turkey's Incirlik Air Base on Sunday, days after Ankara invited the U.S. military, its NATO ally, to use the facility. U.S.-led air campaign began on August the 8th last year with strikes on Islamic State groups, most of those targets in northern Iraq. It expanded the following month to hit many targets and militants as well in northern Syria. VOA's Sharon Bain is in the northern Iraqi Kurdish city of Erbil, where she's been reporting on the impact of the U.S. military effort. My colleague Michael Lippin spoke with her about how the people of the region feel about these airstrikes. Sharon said that they're overwhelmingly supportive of the U.S. air campaign.
There's generally, from everybody I've spoken to, you know, they recognize that, yes, it was the airstrikes that helped the Peshmerga then push the Islamic State back. The Peshmerga fighters who have been partners with the U.S. in this, they also say, you know, don't forget, we played a big role. They were the troops on the ground, and they're quite proud of that role.
Do those forces of the Peshmerga think the United States and its allies should do more to help them in any way?
I think there's a general consensus among the security forces here that they would want more weapons and more sort of support, maybe not necessarily ground forces, but definitely more weapons. What happens is that because the U.S. has to go through Baghdad that would then come up and supply the Kurds. There's some political fighting between Baghdad and the Kurdish center up here as to where, how much independence the Kurds should have when it comes to things like weapons and security and so on. So there's been a little bit of frustration that they could get more help. But overall, because the Islamic State has been pushed out largely of the Kurdish areas, the general feeling here is they're feeling much safer. They don't feel that the threat is on their doorstep as they did before. However, there's still quite a bit of fighting up in the Sinjar area where the Yazidis were. In that area, there's been some new fighting, and there are airstrikes there again.
Well, with the people in Erbil and the surrounding area feeling more secure and also engaging in a political dispute with Baghdad over weapons, is there also a feeling among the Kurds there that the fighting that they've done against the Islamic State with the help of U.S. airstrikes is pushing them further toward a goal of independence from Baghdad, or at least greater autonomy from Baghdad?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the feeling up here is that Kurdistan is a de facto separate country. They don't feel that they're part of Iraq, and the bigger the, you know, disparate situations are, the larger the gap between what's happening in the rest of Iraq with the Islamic State, with the sectarian fighting, that none of that exists up here. And here it's remarkable. You know, you've got supermarkets, you've got malls, you've got an entirely different lifestyle than you would have for example, Baghdad, where you've got bombs going off every day. So the Kurds here actually feel that already they are a de facto, they are their own country. And there's always been a very strong push for independence. I think the fight that the Peshmerga did, they proved, you know, to themselves and to what they feel to Iraq, that they have the ability to defend themselves. And, yeah, I think it did contribute to their sense of independence.
The situation in Erbil, as you say, feels quite normal compared to the rest of Baghdad, to the rest of Iraq and Baghdad, for example. But what about compared to Mosul, which is Iraq's second biggest city and isn't too far away?
Well, that's the ironic part. And when I speak to people here, you know, they sometimes look up and you know, for example, there are cafes on the street where people are playing dominoes and drinking coffee. And when I've stopped and spoken to people, they seem, you know, it's almost quite, they will answer almost like they're shocked that Mosul is less than an hour away. Less than an hour away as the crow flies. You've got the Islamic State conducting, you know, barbarous behavior. And here it's just, it's like a different universe. You wouldn't even be able to tell that they were only an hour away. But, you know, when you travel outside of the city, there's definitely a sort of, you know, be careful and you don't go, you know, don't stray too far. They do realize that the threat is not too far, but overall they seem to feel pretty comfortable. And I know that they feel very comfortable with the help of the United States.
That is VOA Sharon Bain in Erbil, Iraq. She was speaking with International Edition's Michael Lippin. Now a look at what's being said on social media about the U.S. airstrikes against the Islamic State, sometimes called ISIL. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins us. Hello, G.
Hi, Steve. Like Sharon just said, the U.S. air offensive in northern Iraq and Syria is widely welcomed by the Kurds. And the U.S. mission to NATO announced the latest decision to strengthen its air campaign in the region Sunday. The mission is on Twitter at USNATO and wrote this tweet. 6 U.S. Air Force F-16 fighter Falcons deployed to Incirlik Air Base, Turkey, to support the fight against ISIL. That's been retweeted more than 140 times and marked as a favorite more than 70 times.
And, of course, that's great news for the Kurds, mm-hmm. I'm sure. What kind of response did it get?
It got some colorful comments on Twitter. One user wrote, "When will the Americans stop breaking the international law and the UN regulations?" Another user tweeted, "Don't forget to bomb the PKK," referring to the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is in conflict with the Turkish government.
And gee, what other government accounts shared the news?
A couple of them, actually. The Defense Department at DEPT of Defense confirmed the news, and the tweet reads like this. U.S. Air Force deployed 6 F-16 Fighting Falcons from Aviano to Incirlik in support of Operation Inherent Resolve. The first air base is in Italy and the latter is in Turkey. Steve, the White House National Security Council also tweeted about the deployment around the same time as the Defense Department. It's on Twitter at NSC Press. The tweet's content is about the same, but unlike the other two tweets that I just mentioned, it used hashtag ISIL and hashtag OIR, meaning the Operation Inherent Resolve. As you know, the operation is aimed at eliminating the ISIL. Steve?
Many thanks, G. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. Here's a reminder, you can follow International Edition on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. Still ahead, the upsurge in violence in Afghanistan. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. In the news, the Taliban has claimed responsibility for another deadly suicide car bombing in Afghanistan. Came a day after a series of terrorist blasts killed more than 50 in and around Kabul. Well, the Afghan capital, as you might imagine, is nervous. The people are on edge after the worst outbreak of terrorism since the Taliban confirmed that it's under new leadership following the death of its founder, Mullah Omar. And after the news of Omar's death, Mullah Akhtar Mansour was chosen to lead the Taliban, with some analysts at the time indicating choosing Mansour might create a schism in the Taliban. For some perspective on the upsurge of Taliban attacks in Afghanistan, VOA's Victor Beatty asked Jonah Blank, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, what is the Taliban's strategy?
Well, I think the real question is, what is the Taliban? we no longer know exactly who is in charge. Mullah Mansour is the self-proclaimed inheritor of the mantle of Mullah Omar, but he has a lot of internal opposition, and it's unclear just who he controls within the Taliban. It's unclear whether the people launching these attacks are loyal to the Quetta Shura leadership or are trying to assert their own role and perhaps assert themselves as the legitimate leadership of the Taliban. So I think the real question is not what's the Taliban strategy, but what is the Taliban going to look like now that Mullah Omar is confirmed dead?
Does this complicate the peace process?
It does, because right now we don't know who, if anyone, is authorized to speak on behalf of the Taliban. On the downside, there will be a period of transition where there will be no legitimate interlocutor who has the standing to make a deal. In the medium term, in the longer term, there is a possibility that this will work out in a good way for two reasons. First, we may see a split in the Taliban and a lot of internal feuding, which could really weaken their hand on the battlefield and at the negotiating table. More importantly, we may well see a leader emerge, whether it is Mullah Mansour or another leader, who has the ability to make a deal and come forward and say, I'm alive. I'm not a mythical figure. You don't have to worry about whether you're making a deal with a corpse. Here I am, and I can make this deal. We didn't really have that before. So there are definitely going to be some rough patches ahead, but it's possible that the passing of Mullah Omar will really turn out to be a movement for peace.
In Washington, the White House said National Security Advisor Susan Rice spoke with Afghan President Ashraf Ghani by phone, expressing U.S. condolences. President Obama's counterterror advisor Lisa Monica also spoke with the Afghan National Security Advisor. Is expressing U.S. concern about this attack?
I think it is right to express concern about it, and more importantly, to express condolences for the lives lost, appreciation for the sacrifices made, and confidence in the course that the Afghan government is setting. Let's remember, all of these attacks over the weekend occurred outside the gates of these posts. Nobody was able to breach the inner portion of these fortified places where Afghan and U.S. Military have been garrisoned. That's really a testament to the improved professionalism of the Afghan National Security Forces.
Well, that's an interesting statement that you make. Overall, I was going to ask what your assessment is in these last, since the beginning of 2015, the last several months, how the Afghan security forces have been performing with a lower profile among NATO forces.
I think they've been performing pretty well, certainly as well as could be expected. They're not going to be able to perform at the level of the U.S. military. The U.S. military is the best trained, best equipped fighting force in the world, so it would be quite unrealistic to hold them to that standard. Most importantly, the Afghan National Security Force doesn't have the air mobility to be all places at all times. One of the reasons that the U.S. and the international forces could be so effective is that they have air mobility. They could, or they did when they were there in force, they could get anywhere in the country relatively quickly. The Afghan National Security Force does not have that ability. That means that when the Taliban can mass for an attack, whether it's in Kunduz, whether it is in any other province, they can probably overwhelm a small garrison, but they can't hold it, or at least they've so far not been able to hold it.
That is Jonah Blank, a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. An anthropologist by training, Blank is the author of many books, including Mullahs on the Mainframe. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty. Also in the news, a car bomb Sunday reportedly detonated in the eastern city of Derna in Libya, killing at least 7 people, wounding nearly 20 others. Derna has been the scene of Islamist fighting involving various militia groups and the Islamic State. Meanwhile, Libya peace talks between representatives of the country's rival governments are expected to resume today in Geneva, aimed at forging a national unity government in a bid to bring order out of the chaos there that's gripped the North African country since the ouster of dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. At least 10 civilians were reportedly killed by gunmen that happened in an attack in the northern Malian village of Gaberi. Reuters is reporting the attacks by three men on motorcycles began late on Saturday. The attack was repulsed by village residents who killed one of the gunmen. A security source Sunday said at least nine civilians, including five UN workers, were killed in a day-long siege happened at a hotel in the central town of Savari that ended early Saturday with an attack by soldiers and left four attackers dead. There was no claim of responsibility, but it comes amid a string of attacks linked to jihadist groups. A policeman and a police recruit were killed. It happened Sunday after a roadside bomb targeted their vehicle in Al Arish, the capital of Egypt's North Sinai Peninsula. The region is active in elements of the Egyptian affiliate of the Islamic State known as the Sinai Province, formerly Ansar Beit al-Maqdis. Hundreds more migrants were rescued Saturday and Sunday trying to make that dangerous journey across the Mediterranean from Libya and southern Europe. Most aboard overcrowded boats or inflatable dinghies at risk of capsizing. More than 200 Africans in two rubber boats were rescued by the medical charity Doctors Without Borders on the vessel Bourbon Argos. Among those rescued was this Nigerian.
I left Nigeria because of the crisis of Boko Haram. And everybody knew about Boko Haram in the press. And I lost my family. No, my house was burned into ashes. So that's the reason that makes me shift it to Libya. From Libya, I decide to shift to Italy.
The UN Refugee Agency estimates that 224,000 migrants, most of them from Africa, have made that risky journey across the Mediterranean so far. More than 2,100 have perished in that attempt, compared with nearly 3,300 last year. Some U.S. media reporting suspected Russian hackers have penetrated the email network of the U.S. Defense Department's Joint Chiefs of Staff. NBC News, which first broke the story, said it was not clear if the attack was the work of the Russian government or individuals. VOA's cyber correspondent Doug Bernard discussed the hacking incident with International Edition's Peter Heinlein, who asked him what the hackers might have stolen.
We don't know what was lost. We can speculate. But again, this is the email system and unclassified that was used by the staff of the Joint Chiefs. So probably a lot of, you know, logistical type information, meetings, that kind of thing. But nothing that would reach a classified or certainly a top secret level of communication or information.
So just your normal emails, probably.
Probably. The Defense Department may be more forthcoming about what specifically was targeted or was lost. Some of that may be privileged information. We'll just have to wait and see.
Now, they use a technique called spear phishing.
Right.
Can you talk about spear phishing?
Sure.
I don't know what that is.
Except out in the great briny, I suppose. Well, spear phishing has been around for a very long time. In effect, it's when an individual, a bad guy, let's say, sends somebody else, let's say a good guy, an email that purports to maybe come from their friend or a colleague or an associate. And very often, they'll say, you know, hi, Pete, it's been a long time. So-and-so suggested I get in contact with you. I wanted to share this link with you, or here's the document you asked for. What they're trying to do is get you to click on something. And once you do, of course, that's the opening, that's the infection.
Shouldn't the people at the Joint Chiefs of Staff be sophisticated enough to catch those things?
Well, you know, here's the thing. They're human. And really, spear phishing, it's a very simple technique, but we see it used again and again for years, even though we know how to protect ourselves, because we're human. And it's a very easy thing to fall for. One analyst I spoke with said, well, you know, we keep seeing it because it keeps working.
how can they tell if it's a foreign state? They think it's Russia, but how can they tell?
Well, there are various fingerprints and also sort of techniques that can distinguish where an attack may be from or who may be behind it. Now, I'm using maybe because attribution at 100% certainty is, I don't think it's even possible. But there are digital fingerprints, some very basic and others very complex and sort of refined that researchers have gotten to be pretty good with. And so what they do is many of them are tracking what are known as advanced persistent threats, or APTs. And there's a number of these APT groups in Russia. And generally speaking, the spear phishing attack is not one of them, but generally speaking, the more sophisticated the attack, the more likely that there was a state sponsorship somewhere in there.
That was VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard. He was speaking with International Edition's Peter Heinlein. You can check out Doug's postings at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Do you like to sleep on your back or on your stomach? If so, you may want to think about some new findings from researchers at Stony Brook University in New York. The researchers discovered that sleeping on your side might help your body remove potentially harmful leftover chemical components from your brain, components that are implicated in neurological diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. The researchers studied MRI images of the glymphatic pathway, which is a complex system for clearing waste, in the brains of sedated rodents as they slept on their back, front, and side positions. The researchers found that waste transport was most efficient when the rodent slept on its side, and say that further MRI imaging research with humans is necessary. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. It's time now for our music feature, and some of the top stars of R&B music, including Queen Latifah and Mary J. Blige, have signed on to star in a new production of The Wiz. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Shauna Renee about the show, also about a new Miles Davis movie from Oscar nominee Don Cheadle.
We already know that Queen Latifah and Mary J. Blige have both signed on to be a part of what they are calling a live production, a live stage event that's going to air on television here in the States. Queen Latifah signed on very early on to play The Wiz, which I think is going to be very interesting.
That's an interesting choice.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, first of all, we never thought of The Wiz as being female. And Queen Latifah, as we know, is quite the presence anyway. So I am looking so forward to seeing what she does with that role. Also, Mary J. Blige is going to be playing Eveline, the Wicked Witch of the West.
Get out.
Which I think is probably, I can't imagine anyone else really playing that, because obviously this is a musical. This is based on The Wiz,
right,
which was based on The Wizard of Oz. We all know The Wizard of Oz, but it was in the context of African-American culture. And it started off as a stage play in the mid-70s, and then it became one of my favorite movies of all time in the late 70s. The stage play starring Stephanie Mills, and the movie starring Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, Lena Horne. So it was a huge movie and a cultural event. So we just learned that Amber Riley, who is from Glee, she's a very popular young lady out of Glee, has been added to the cast. And what I thought was really interesting is that Uzo Aduba has been added to the cast as well. Now, many people may not know the name, but she plays Crazy Eyes on Orange is the New Black, which is a hugely successful television show. Many people know her as an actress, but do not realize that she's also played on Broadway, and she was an opera singer. She is a fabulous voice. So this will be the first time that we'll be able to see her and hear her in this form. And she'll be playing Glinda.
Wow.
The Good Witch of the
North.
North, yeah. Yes, of the North, yes.
Well, now, I also understand you were telling me that Don Cheadle's got a new project coming out?
Now, this is a bit different because the whole movie covers a few days in which Miles Davis disappeared into his Manhattan apartment and was reportedly haunted by his ex-wife and his glory days and images. And knowing Miles Davis, this was probably brought on by a substance or two.
A chemical or two, yeah.
But for a few days there, people were wondering where he was. What was he doing? He just went completely missing, and a Rolling Stone reporter was the one that eventually broke into the house and found him. And so Don Cheadle has been working on this project for some time, and he recently got a distribution deal with Sony. And I understand that it's going to be screened at the closing night ceremonies for the New York Film Festival, which is a huge, huge deal. And from what I understand, Don does a fabulous job portraying Miles Davis.
I definitely am looking forward to that. I'm a big fan of his. And if you're a fan of Shauna, you can send her a tweet at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at VOA underscore music. You can listen for her in the Soul Lounge. That's at our website, www.voanews.com.
Yeah, I can fully get Don Cheadle as Miles Davis, even in that kind of goofy situation. One of my favorite stars as well. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned. Latest news straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, recently announced a $65 million contribution to the UN World Food Program, or WFP. This will allow the organization to continue to provide emergency food assistance to some 4 million Syrians inside the country and approximately 1.6 million refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, and Egypt. The funds will help keep WFP programs operating through November and avert an imminent shutdown. The United States is the single largest donor of humanitarian assistance to the Syrian crisis, providing more than $4 billion to help millions of people inside Syria and beyond its borders to receive food, shelter, education, urgent medical care, and much-needed relief supplies. USAID has now given more than $1.2 billion to WFP for its Syrian operations. This includes more than $530 million for operations inside Syria and over $693 million for operations benefiting Syrian refugees. While USAID remains the World Food Program's largest donor for the Syria response, a lack of robust funding from the international community has forced WFP to reduce food voucher values by as much as half for refugees and lower the amount of food in monthly household parcels inside Syria. The United States continues to encourage other donors to alleviate these and other critical humanitarian needs. We urge all governments to fulfill unfunded pledges. The most recent contribution from USAID has helped WFP avoid having to make additional program cuts, including curtailing all emergency food assistance to Syrian refugees in Jordan who live in host communities, which would have begun August 1st. We have heard tragic stories of hungry refugees returning to war-torn Syria and taking children out of school to beg, said Dina Esposito, director of USAID's Office of Food for Peace. We hope this new funding will help mitigate such difficult choices and help Syrians as the winter months approach. Since 2013, the WFP voucher program, funded significantly by USAID, has provided critical food assistance to Syrian refugees while also contributing about $1 billion to the economies of Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, Egypt, and Iraq, all nations who have so generously opened their doors to refugees. Inside Syria, WFP's food parcel distributions have helped feed millions of conflict-affected people. The United States remains committed to working with international partners to help meet the desperate food needs of the Syrian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's for, what's your